Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, just in time for Halloween, AWM program director Allison Sansoni talks with historian Scott Peoples about Edgar Allan Poe and his book, The Man of the Crowd, Edgar Allan Poe and the City. This conversation originally took place October 27th, 2020, and was recorded live via Zoom. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
My name is Allison Sansoni. I'm the program director here at the American Writers Museum. We're grateful to all of you for being here and for valuing the past, present, and future of American writing. Our guest for this Halloween time program chronicles the urban life of one of America's best known writers of scary stories to tell in the dark. Dr. Scott Peoples has published extensively on Edgar Allan Poe and other 19th century writers, most recently as co-editor of the Oxford Handbook to Edgar Allan Poe. His newest book, The Man of the Crowd, Edgar Allan Poe and the City, draws on Poe's experiences living among the soldiers, enslaved people, and immigrants of the American city to challenge the misconception of Poe as a solitary figure living in isolation. And if there's one thing that we want to challenge right now, it's the idea of isolation. So welcome, Dr. Peoples.
Hi, thank you, Allison. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. I wanted to start us off by talking about Poe generally. Can you tell us what your first encounter was with his work and how that so captured your attention that you sort of chose him as a subject for your scholarship?
I think my first encounter was probably hearing Poe stories retold by my older sisters to scare me when I was, when I was a little kid, and just the scenarios of the Telltale Heart and the Cask of Amontillado. And so I liked Poe the whole time I was growing up. So I was, naturally drawn to people being buried alive and dismembered. I really began to take Poe seriously and think about him in a different way as a graduate student. In fact, this book is dedicated to Jerry Kennedy, who was my mentor in graduate school. And it was in a course on the modern short story that he taught that I realized that Poe was more than the master of the macabre, that he was one of the architects of the modern short story. And I began to think about him in a different way.
Yeah. Poe's included in our American Writers Museum exhibit, American Voices, which highlights the writers whose work had a profound impact on American culture and remains relevant to this day. What do you think makes Poe such an enduring writer, and what can people learn today by reading him?
Well, there are, there are a lot of things that I think makes Poe enduring. Part of it is because I think his work is more multifaceted than a lot of people realize. Detective stories, I think, are always appealing to people, and Poe was, virtually the inventor of the modern detective story. I think the way that he explores questions about life and death. I mean, to put it bluntly and simply, Poe explores what happens when we die and the uncertainties and the fears that come with that. And that's something that is not going to go away. So I think people will always, in addition to the attraction that we might have to the kind of sensational elements in Poe's story, I think that the way that he explores those kinds of existential questions really keep people coming back. I think the psychological depth to his stories, the question of motive, why would somebody do this, but the clues that are left in stories to try to tease that out. I think that's another aspect of Poe that people are always going to be drawn to.
Your new book takes on the idea that a lot of people have of Poe as a solitary man working alone in a tower. Other than mixing him up with Nathaniel Hawthorne, how did we develop this misconception, and how did you go about challenging it?
You know, I think that Poe contributed to it to some extent himself, because while in this book, I try to emphasize the places where Poe lived, Poe didn't, he didn't market himself as a regional writer. He didn't associate himself closely in his fiction with a specific particular place. So, you know, where is the House of Usher? You know, we don't know. What is the city in which the Telltale Heart is set? I mean, there's no indication of that. So Poe, you know, particularly in his most famous works, he left those kinds of details out. And so I think that there was less reason for fans to think of him. I mean, you mentioned Hawthorne. We think of Hawthorne and we think of Salem. Right, and we think of Thoreau and Emerson, and we think of Concord. You know, we think of Concord, Massachusetts. But with Poe, there's no place like that where you can just say this is Poe country right here. And I think Poe did that deliberately. So there's this, and then his poetry has this kind of mystical, otherworldly quality. And a lot of people have commented on that and seen Poe as the kind of person who dreams up imaginary worlds, and that makes you think, oh well, he must just be a loner. He must, you know, he must not be mixing with the people around him. So that's, you know, I think that just built up over time in terms of Poe's image, and drawing on the work that a lot of scholars have done over the years to dispel that image, I wanted to write a book that would really put Poe in the places where he lived, in the cities, in the neighborhoods, and really kind of try to drive the point home that he was very much involved in the world around him and in 19th century American life.
Yeah. Why was it important to cite him in these particular places?
Well, first of all, these are not the only places Poe lived. I chose the four cities where he spent the most time. And I wanted to build the narrative around those four places. I mean, to some extent, that was a way to structure the book more than anything else. But I think it's also significant that these were the places where Poe found work. He worked for the Southern Literary Messenger in Richmond. He began entering short story contests and sending his work to magazines in Baltimore. That's sort of where he kind of found his calling, if you will, as a fiction writer. When he moved to Philadelphia, he worked as an editor at Burton's Gentleman's Magazine and then at Graham's Magazine. He went to New York because by that point, New York was the mecca of the publishing world. So I'm also trying to tell the story of Poe trying to have a career, not only as a writer, but as an editor and a critic. And that career had to take place in the cities where publishing was centered and where magazines were being produced.
What was the urban literary life like during the time that he was, you know, trying to live it? His movements were partially because of poverty, correct?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, particularly his movements within cities, I think were driven by seeking cheaper rent, and at times trying to find a healthier environment for himself, but more than that, for his wife, who contracted tuberculosis in the early 1840s. So that combination of her poor health and poverty, I think, drove a lot of his decisions about where to live. And he was often conflicted between, on one hand, wanting to be close to where the action was in terms of publishing, but on the other hand, not wanting to be too much in the densest part of the city where I mean, sometimes that would be inexpensive rent, but at other times it was more expensive. But it was certainly not what he considered to be the healthiest, and he was right, the healthiest environment for Virginia, his wife.
In the book's introduction, you describe Poe as not so much uprooted as unrooted. And I found that really and a really interesting choice of words. What is the distinction between those two for you, and why do you make it?
Well, I think the reason I would describe Poe as unrooted is that he was born into a family that was on the road. They were his mother was a popular actress. His father was a not so popular actor, and they would stay in one place for as long as a season in a theater might last. And so they didn't really have roots. And so the first 3 years of Poe's life, up until the time that his mother died, he really did not have a place to call home. I mean, he was part of a family, but he wasn't part of a community or in any way settled. And so I think he was already, you know, his life had already gotten off to that kind of start. And then even though he did find a foster family with the Allens and some stability in Richmond, he knew that he was a foster son. And the Allens, particularly John Allen, were not inclined to let him forget that. So even when he had that measure of stability and a sort of hometown in Richmond, I think that his, I think his deeper sense was, I don't know if I really belong here. I don't know if I'm really a member of this family, much less a member of this community. So, yeah, I mean, I think he was never really, he never had that kind of sense of rootedness or of home to begin with. And, you know, one of the threads that runs throughout the book is I think he was looking for that and never really quite finding it.
So instead of the trauma of having something removed, it's that outsider's perspective of never having had it in the first place. And it's sort of a mystery to him.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, traditionally, I think this is true. I mean, Poe, the big trauma of his early life was the death of his mother. I'm looking at it. I mean, I'm not denying that, but I'm looking at it in a slightly through a slightly different lens, having more to do with place. And in that sense, yeah, what you just said is pretty much my take on it. That he, you know, he never had that sense of rootedness to begin with.
Yeah. Of the four cities that you focused on, which one did you find had the most profound impact on his work?
Oh boy.
Favorite.
That's a tough question because I'm not sure who might be here and what city they might be from. and this, you know, and this can get, you know, pretty, it can get a little dicey between Poe cities. Honestly, it's not an easy question to answer, even if I wasn't fearful of retribution. I would say though that I think I probably got into the Philadelphia chapter and found more to write about in that chapter more easily compared to the other three, with New York probably a close second. Of course, I love Richmond and Baltimore too, but I mean, in terms of when things were really happening for Poe, and my book is really very much about his career. And so I will say, I think he hit his stride as a fiction writer in Philadelphia. And I think it's undeniable that that's where he did the majority of his best work, particularly in fiction. That's where he wrote the first two detective stories, The Telltale Heart, The Black Cat, The Fall of the House of Usher, Ligeia, The Pit and the Pendulum, The Mask of the Red Death. I mean, it's his greatest hits right there in Philadelphia. So I found that between the things that were going on in Philadelphia at the time and the ways that I could write about the city and what was happening in post-career, I would say, not by a long shot, but that was probably the chapter that I had the most trouble sort of reining in that almost could have been a book in itself.
That was where the connections were the most obvious.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. As a writer yourself, how do you assess the impact of someone's surroundings on their written work? Can that be measured or quantified in some way, or is it unique to each writer?
Oh, I think it's definitely unique to each writer. And with Poe, part of the challenge was what I had referred to earlier, is that he doesn't make it obvious, at least not in his most famous works. So I think the impacts in some cases were subtle, and other people might read the book and take issue with the way that I interpreted them. Because, you know, I would contend that a story doesn't have to be set in Philadelphia to be about what Poe is experiencing in Philadelphia. And the same is true of the other cities as well. So there's some of that. And then there are also, you know, less well-known works that really are set in the cities where Poe was living at the time. Doings of Gotham would be the most obvious. It's a series of journalistic sketches of New York that Poe wrote not long after he got to New York. It's all about New York. But it's not something that most people, you know, even know about, much less read today.
What was your process for researching this book? How did you begin your research? How did you sort of sustain it throughout the process?
That's a really great question. I mean, part of it really goes, I mean, I've been working on Poe and writing about Poe for a long time. It sounds like kind of a non-answer to say, well, I've been writing this book for, you know, for 25 or 30 years, but to some extent that's kind of true. But I really started thinking about writing a book about Poe and place and Poe in specific cities around 2009. Which was the bicentennial of Poe's birth. And Paul Lewis, who is he teaches at Boston College, and he's done a lot of work to sort of put Boston more prominently on the map of Poe places, and he's done an incredible job of it. But Paul invited me to give a talk on Poe at the bicentennial celebration in Boston in 2009. And that was when I really started thinking about this. I worked on it sort of intermittently over the next 4 or 5 years, writing conference papers and articles about Poe's experience in different places and the problem of talking about place when it comes to Poe. And then it started to coalesce, and I started to think about it, you know, in pretty much the terms that the book ended up in. Probably around 2014 or so. And that's when I went to talk to my friend Michelle Van Paris, who's a photographer who did these wonderful photographs that appear in the book, and started asking her about the possibility of doing a book that would combine photographs and text. And from that point on, you know, Michelle and I collaborated, and the book, you know, it sort of went from there. But I mean, it really, there was a long time where I was writing a little bit at a time, writing short things that I was thinking, eventually I'll fold this into the book. And then eventually when we got the contract for the book, that's when I knew, okay, I've got to fill in all of those big gaps and really, you know, get serious about writing this as a book. And at that point, that's when I really started devoting nonstop time to it.
I was going to ask you about the photographs in the book. Why was it important to include so many images?
Well, since the book is about place and about these cities, I really thought it was important to give readers not only archival images, which we also have in the book, but also photographs that would sort of evoke what I was trying to convey. It's hard to pin down, but you know, I felt like on one hand, the archival images don't quite do justice to the places, especially to places like the Poe House in Baltimore, the Poe House in Philadelphia. But on the other hand, I didn't want it to be touristy. I mean, I didn't want it to be, about the marketing of Poe or about Poe tourism. So that was sort of Michelle's job, to take photographs of places that still exist and photographs that, you know, are clearly created in the 20-teens, but which somehow hopefully give readers some sense of Poe's own lived experience in those places. One of the things that Michelle did that I really like in several of the photographs is she blended archival photographs with a photograph of the same site that she took. And I think those are some of the most interesting images in the book.
You mentioned, you know, you've studied and worked on Poe for many years now. I'm not going to ask you if you ever get tired of him, but how do you keep a subject fresh? How do you continue to learn new things about a subject after a time?
Honestly, I would say it's being part of a community of scholars and writers. Having worked on Poe for a long time, I have a lot of friends who work on Poe, and I read their work if they want some feedback, and they do the same for me. And I try to keep up with what people are publishing about Poe, that really keeps me interested, because Poe is the kind of writer that people are always going to find new things to say about. It may be hard to discover new facts about Poe's life because there have been so many biographies and there's been so much work in that regard. But new ways of reading his work, new contexts, it's amazing the freshness of a lot of the work that still comes out on Poe and that younger scholars are doing. And so that's my answer, and that's how I stay interested in Poe, and why I want to keep working on him.
Another writer just once described what a literary scholar chooses to specialize in as what stays alive in their mind when you thought about and looked at everything else. What sticks there, and obviously Poe was that for you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really true. And I think, to some extent, just to kind of go back to one of the first things we talked about, the fact that there is more to Poe than I think his popular image suggests can be sort of a driving force. You get a little bit evangelical about it. Like, I want people to know that Poe was versatile, that he didn't own, I mean, as much as I love the Gothic stories and the most famous poems, I want people to know that he could do more than that. That wasn't the way that he saw himself. I think that's something that I've fixated on, and other scholars have as well. To sort of, just try to let people know that there's more to Poe than you see on the Barnes & Noble bag,
or the Raven T-shirt, right?
Or the Raven T-shirts, yeah.
Yeah.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
We can have a little bit of fun with it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And believe me, I mean, I do more. Probably 4/5 of the talks that I've given on Poe in my career have been within a couple of weeks of Halloween. So I don't mind. I'm happy to be part of that.
It's just because it's seasonal doesn't mean it's inappropriate.
Right.
Well, I wanted to ask you if there is a passage you wanted to read for us.
Thanks. I'd like to read the last few pages of the chapter on Philadelphia, which is chapter 3. And this is mostly about Poe's alcoholism. So it's not it's not strictly narrative. It's you sort of using this moment toward the end of Poe's time in Philadelphia to comment on the problems that the problems that sort of grew out of his drinking problem. The onset of Virginia's illness and Poe's departure from Graham's not only led to the family's move from the old place to the northern suburbs, the disruption also spawned frequent episodes of drunkenness after a long period of relative sobriety. Genetically predisposed to alcoholism and low alcohol tolerance, Poe wasn't helped in having come of age at a time when men typically drink throughout the day, every day, and by living in cities with drinking establishments on nearly every block. Per capita alcohol consumption in the United States seems to have peaked around 1830 when Poe was 21. And there were over 900 taverns in Philadelphia in 1841, including one run by C.W. House a block away from Poe's Spring Garden abode. Meanwhile, though, the temperance movement was changing attitudes toward drinking, reducing alcohol sales dramatically by the 1840s. The movement's success also meant that there were now many men and women making a point of abstaining and seeking to reform others, which is probably one reason reports of Poe's drinking appear as often as they do. Poe's sober contemporaries were not likely to dismiss or normalize his drinking problem, nor were they likely to regard it as an illness, but rather as a character flaw. For example, when Poe's employer William Burton opened his own theater in 1840, he took the principled step of banning the sale of alcohol on the premises. Not surprisingly, Burton clashed with Poe over his drinking and publicly referred to his former editor's infirmities in apologizing for a subscription error. Thomas Dunn English, another teetotaler, had been Poe's friend when he worked for Burton's, but when the two men had a falling out, largely as a result of an alcohol-fueled insult, English broadcast Poe's drinking problem through a thinly veiled caricature in his novel, The Doom of the Drinker, which was serialized in the Coldwater magazine in 1843. This is not to say that Burton or English exaggerated Poe's drinking problem, rather that as temperance men, they judged him for it and had no compunction about publicly shaming him. In reminiscences published long after Poe's death, Thomas Dunn English elaborated on his history with Poe, corroborating other claims that Poe managed to stay sober for significant periods of time, but was incapable of drinking moderately. English recalled one occasion when he found Poe struggling in a vain attempt to raise himself from the gutter. He guided his staggering companion home. "I knocked on the door," he said, "and Mrs. Clem opened it. Raising her voice, she cried, 'You make Eddie drunk, and then you bring him home.' As I was turning away, Poe grasped me by the shoulder and said, 'Never mind the old blank. Come in.' I shook myself from his clutch, and merely telling Mrs. Clem that if I found Eddie in the gutter again, I'd leave him there, went on my way. 3 days after, when I saw Poe, for if I remember rightly, the next 2 days he was not at the office, he was heartily ashamed of the matter and said it was an unusual thing with him and would never occur again." English's detailed account is noteworthy for the disdain he expressed half a century after the fact toward drunken Edgar, as well as Maria's insinuation that he, English, was a drinking companion. The cost of alcoholism to Poe's social life and career was enormous. Knowing that he should abstain altogether, Poe probably felt trapped by invitations to have a drink. He could either appear antisocial by declining or become truly antisocial by drinking to excess. He probably did not drink at home. In fact, being away from home for an extended time increased the likelihood of an embarrassing episode. In the summer of 1842, during the crisis period following Virginia's first hemorrhage, Poe traveled to New York looking for work, probably contemplating a relocation of cities after leaving the old place near Rittenhouse Square. He became intoxicated, apparently for several days, and was eventually found in the woods near Jersey City, wandering about like a crazy man, in the words of his former girlfriend, Mary Starr, who saw him on that trip. In March 1843, Poe made a week-long trip to Washington, D.C. to solicit subscriptions and contributions for his prospective magazine, which was now called The Stylus. and more important, to try to attain a government appointment with the help of Frederick Thomas, who was a friend of President John Tyler's son, Robert. But Frederick Thomas fell ill and was unavailable as a guide. Poe made the rounds with his friend Jesse Dow, but he began drinking and behaving badly. Dow reported back to Thomas Clark, who was Poe's business partner for the Stylus, that Poe had become quite unreliable and that he, quote, exposes himself here to those who may injure him very much with the president. Among the men Poe insulted in Washington was none other than Thomas Dunn English. Not only did Poe not get the clerkship he sought, but in the aftermath of the Washington episode, he also lost the financial support of Clark, who, like English, was a temperance advocate. Poe's drinking and erratic behavior might not have been the sole cause, but it seems to have troubled Clark. In any case, the breakup of the short-lived partnership of Clark and Poe dashed Poe's renewed hopes for establishing a Philadelphia-based magazine. Poe moved the family from Philadelphia to New York in April 1844. Many years later, Thomas Dunn English suggested that there was a specific disreputable cause for Poe's departure. He said, "I am the sole possessor of this scandalous secret, and as its recital would do no good to anyone, the whole affair shall be buried with me." There might have been a scandalous explanation for Poe's departure from Philadelphia, but none is necessary. Poe wasn't making enough money. He was drinking too much, and he was alienating his friends. He needed a new start in a new environment, a city with prospects for steady income. Down but not out in the months before leaving Philadelphia, he began lecturing on the state of American poetry. He spoke to an overflow crowd at Juliana Street Church, not far from his home in Spring Garden, on November 21st, 1843. A week later at Temperance Hall, ironically enough, in Wilmington, Delaware. On December 23rd at Newark Academy in Delaware, and at the Philadelphia Museum on January 10th, and in Baltimore on January 31st. His 6 years in Philadelphia had not radically changed Poe, but they had advanced his career significantly as an editor, critic, and cryptographer, while giving rise to his full development as a writer of tales. Though his identity had largely been formed in Richmond, Poe was no Southern stranger in a strange Northern land. He adopted Philadelphia for as long as he lived there, made friends and enemies, and generally immersed himself in the city's print and periodical culture. At the same time, he responded, mostly in fiction, to some of the mid-19th century city's defining characteristics: alienation, ethnic diversity, racial tension, and the inscrutability of the urban landscape and its inhabitants.
Thank you very much for being here for this conversation, Dr. Peoples. And thank you to everyone for being here with us tonight. We appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, we will catch up with Asali Solomon to talk to her about her new book, The Days of Afrakiti. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.